Ladies and gentlemen, podcasting since 2005, you're listening to Gamertag Radio with your host, podcaster Hall of Famer Danny Pena, the always opinionated Paris Lilly, and from outside of the norm, Peter Toledo. This is Gamertag Radio.
Welcome now to the workshop, Surviving in a Mid-Crisis State. We've obviously spent a lot of time with Julian and Chloe today, but I'm excited to introduce you to Tricia Watschendorf, the director at the Disaster Research Center. Welcome, Tricia.
Thanks so much. I met a couple of you today. It's great to be here.
Awesome. So, you know, today, the Division 2, it portrays this plausible scenario where society has collapsed quickly and turned into the state of crisis in, you know, just a few months. So it really highlights the fragility of our society, and that's something that Tricia spent a lot of time researching. So Tricia, I'll let you take it away.
Sure. And so if you think about the important components of what actually makes for a functioning community, that's governance, it's communication, it's health, it's education, it's housing, it's transportation. And then think about all the systems that go in to support that community functioning and how tightly coupled they actually are in a modernized society. So imagine a widespread blackout that's region-wide. That has an impact beyond me having candlelight dinner with my husband or going with the kids and eating all the ice cream from the fridge before it melts. It impacts commerce, and not just e-commerce, but my ability to sell goods to you and for your ability to buy and get the goods that you need without access to a credit card and without access to a bank machine. Think about communication, our ability to communicate with each other inside that impacted area, but also to communicate with people outside the area in a sustained way to update them on what we need and where exactly to direct those resources to. Think about the electronic health records that we all rely upon now. So that's an issue not only in a regional power outage that lasts a long time, but that's what happened in 2018 with the malware attack in the UK. The supplies that a community needs to sustain itself, how much we rely on roads and rail, on ports and planes, on bridges and tunnels to get the goods that we need in a community to function in an economy that really relies on just-in-time supply chains. So it makes sense generally that we have these tightly coupled systems. It works for efficiency, but that generates particular vulnerabilities that can put us at risk.
I mean, if that's what we see in the beginning of the first division.
Right. Does any of this sound familiar? I mean, when we announced the division in 2013, it came with that motion graphics clip, which had this super accelerated timeline, which was day one, this happens, day two, this happens. And all of these things, all of these systems are very tightly coupled. So the division was based around the fantasy of a pandemic. You know, it was based on some research that we did on a U.S. government study called Dark Winter that showed that the country at that time wasn't ready for a bioterrorist attack. So we pushed the fantasy much further, and of course it's an accelerated timeline in the game. But all of these things ring true, they ring plausible, and that's kind of scary. And it's this cascading domino effect that we started the first game with, and yet 7 months later we find ourselves in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and that again brings us to, Tricia, some of your research obviously has been on the efforts that cities take to mitigate a crisis.
Yeah, and if I could just, before getting to that, bounce back on something you said, because I think it's really important, the domino or cascading effect, and that's cascading disasters is actually something that we look at in these different events. Do any of you remember the 2011 triple disaster in Japan? Made a lot of news coverage. But that was a case where you had an earthquake generating, a large earthquake generating significant impact, but also generating a tsunami that really devastated coastal communities in the entire area of the northern part of Japan. And that tsunami also impacting the cooling system of a nuclear power plant and generating radiation release that communities and cities and rural areas are still grappling with today. So it's a disaster causing a disaster, causing a disaster. And cities being impacted, regions being impacted, national impacts in Japan, and then global impacts as well. So really this tragic example of a real cascading disaster, similar to what you just described.
Absolutely. And in the division, okay, the origin point is the virus, but what you're actually trying to stem is the chaos that's tearing the fabric of society apart. And, you know, that can be seen as part of the cascading effects of what happens in the fiction of the game.
Yeah, we digged a lot into the pandemic preparedness strategy of the United States of America, and we discovered that in the U.S., the government highlights 17 critical infrastructure for that allow the country to work on a daily basis. But these are key systems. But behind these key systems, you have people. And of course, in the U.S., you have a lot of private contractors. Of course, you have the federal government, but these people, if they are sick, if they are ill, if they are touched by the pandemic that we illustrate in the scenario of the division, then who is going to bring the systems together? So these private sectors lack as well of individual and system-wide business continuity to allow the country to work properly. So in a pandemic, you will have dramatic drop of workers coming to work. So you will have a lack of efficiency, and this will have, of course, the domino effect that we just described.
And it's sort of, forgive me, exciting for, as a disaster researcher to hear some of these elements so accurately reflected in the game, because a lot of the attention that we bring to it is how agencies tend to focus on these technical systems and these infrastructure systems, and don't get me wrong, I feel much better that people look at those, but they rely on social systems as well. And the difference between, one of the differences between a disaster and a catastrophe is in a disaster you have officials that can still manage to a certain extent their routine roles. When you look at something that's more catastrophic, the clear characteristic of that is that local officials are unable to do their routine roles. So if they are responsible for some of these other tasks and technical systems, and they're distracted and preoccupied with this unfolding, cascading event, things that we rely upon them to do, it's not that they're necessarily failing, but it becomes so big that they can't both do the routine things as well as deal with the tasks at hand.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Zach. Yeah, so, I mean, on that trip, we've talked a lot about your research trip, I think today in some of the interviews, but I know you met with such a range of different experts, and you saw so many different examples of...
I think the illustration that we all saw this morning, the 17th Street levee system that was supposed to protect the city from the flooding issue, from the flooding risk, is of course a clever idea to make the infrastructure better. But if you don't have these people from the federal government or any other agencies or contractors that are here on site and that are able to bring the concrete pillars together to make sure that the flood barrier works correctly, then you'll have to face some flooding, and then the system is not efficient enough as it was planned. So we discovered during these trips the failure of these systems and how the city can collapse really quickly, even though they prepared themselves and they thought about it. But yeah, I think talking with these experts, even though they are prepared and they are expecting the worst, sometimes you just ignore what can happen, and you just don't know what you don't know.
And that kind of gets at the question I skirted before, returning back about crisis. So one of the things that, when we think about what a crisis is, it involves a real or perceived threat. It involves something that is unexpected and a real sense of urgency. The cornerstone of disaster is crisis. And so there are these aspects that communities engage in to prepare for these types of events, like the levee system that you talked about. And they absolutely should, thinking about things we can't anticipate. But the very definition, again, of disaster is that there's going to be things that we haven't anticipated. And it's a crisis because there's things that are unexpected. So, for example, a city might engage in building and strengthening a levee system or retrofitting a bridge. But it also has to think about what happens when that bridge fails. It has to think about where it might develop public shelters as staging areas, what buildings would be suitable, and how to stockpile them. But it also has to think about what else is in the community in case those buildings are not accessible. What do we do then? It has to train and drill local officials. But it also has to anticipate and appreciate that everyone, and this kind of goes back to FEMA's the Federal Emergency Management Agency's whole community approach, that everyone has a role to play, whether you're a nonprofit organization, a community-based group, an everyday citizen, that everyone has a role to play in mitigating, responding, and recovering from disasters. Something that struck me today when we were out and about in the city, if we're sort of thinking about who we would want to be with in the midst of a crisis or in that recovery process, that early recovery process, some of us might think, well, a police officer or a firefighter or someone with medical skills, and I'll take those too. But think about the woman who was our guide today on the bus and her ability to know the aspects about the levee system and the flooding risks, her ability to identify these components of monuments and buildings and whether something had asbestos or not, to think about a tour guide as being absolutely key in that, or all of the work that the two of you have done over the past few years.
I just make video games.
But someone would say that. But you know, you've delved into these issues, the current plans, looking at buildings. And so someone wouldn't immediately think, oh, a game developer, you know, how are they going to be useful? The fact that you've done that research in D.C., you would have that set of knowledge. So thinking in unexpected ways.
I think this is something also that we noticed when we met locals of D.C. They have so much knowledge about the city, the way it works, because today you have a lot of people that come to D.C. just to work. So on the different cycles, they go back to their home states, for example. So they are just here for just a couple of years, so they don't really know well the city. They are used to use their GPS on a daily basis to go to work, for example. So they don't even know the roads and where they live to. And I think meeting with the locals and, for example, some association of DC and seeing how much knowledge they have on the city, and if there is a crisis, you would like to see these people because they would know, all right, you have a water filtration system in this building that you could use to filter the water or to use it. You would have this food available here because there is a community garden that they take care of in this area of the city. That type of knowledge we discover throughout the locals and people that just are inhabitants of the city for years and years.
Yeah, I think that actually brings us to sort of our next topic of discussion is the theme of hope that we see so much in the Division 2. Mm-hmm.
I think, was it the first time anybody saw the Lincoln Memorial or the Washington Memorial today? When you see those buildings in the flesh, they are incredible symbols, and they have a meaning. They have a meaning today, and I think in the world of the fiction of the Division, they'll still have a meaning afterwards. So take, for example, the Washington Monument. That becomes a a staging area for SARA, which is our version of FEMA. And you can understand that that symbol, what it was before the collapse, becomes something very different after the collapse. And that's something we were chatting about in front of the memorial as well.
Yeah, and to have those symbols really be also a natural gathering point. So to some degree, that might be anticipated ahead of time by different agencies. And it makes sense, right? The layout, and you have all that kind of seemingly flat land before it gets flooded. But also an area for people to gather, to look for information. And then once people start gathering, it begins to take on new meaning. So sometimes you have buildings or parks or squares. In some of our work after the Christchurch earthquake in New Zealand, there was a destroyed church, Christchurch, right, where people kind of went to and came to. So this idea of symbols attracting to us, having those symbols carry on after an event, but also transforming into something new. What does the space mean now? It might not really symbolize the same thing as it did before. It begins to take on new meaning.
And hope within the division is something that I know that the entire team is super passionate about. This is a dark world. We started off talking about the crisis, and I got worried. You know, I wanted to check in on my family. But the world isn't just bleak. There is hope. And this hope is not only in the city streets, but it's also in the settlements. The settlements are incredibly important for us to communicate that by doing these actions, you're going to be building a better tomorrow for the country. There is a hope there. You know, we have certain clips playing behind with kids playing and life returning. That is really important to us.
And that's part of that community functioning that I talked about, right? Education. It may not be that there's a school yet established in the same way that we think about an educational system.
There is, actually.
But
in one
right,
of the settlements,
yeah,
there's a little school that gets established, certainly.
And that starts, right, with collecting books, with people spending time that may be to occupy kids and keep them busy. But eventually that's an educational system that begins to emerge. The same thing in terms of a commerce system begins to emerge in a very rudimentary way, but you begin to get that functioning up and going.
In fact, in one of the settlements, we also have a game corner, because we wanted to give game designers hope for the future as well.
Yeah, I think one thing the settlements show us is how resilient a society really can be.
Yeah, and it's a great point. Sometimes we forget that societies are actually really resilient. So certainly if you have a community that has high functioning before a disaster happened, that's going to have an effect post-disaster in its resilience. But I think we sometimes lose sight of the idea of relationships and networks. It's something in our field we call social capital, that those bonds that we have with family and close friends, the bridging capital that we have with community groups that we are associated with, or I know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who can get something done. The links that we may have to people who are higher decision makers who can help us recover. So then I'm not just looking at the skills and resources that I might have, but I'm looking at the skills that you might have and the resources and tools you might have and how I can draw on that network and really bring that for my resilience and my community's resilience. And then there's something else that really struck me in what you were saying about creativity, and maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit as well, because this idea of emergence in our field is really important. Improvising, not just roles, but also activities, and improvising the tools and resources that we have. I think back to some of the research that we did after a flooding event in Winnipeg, Canada, back in the 1990s. This was a city that had a flood control mechanism well established and in place, but the water started coming in around the backside and threatened to inundate the city. In a matter of a couple of days, so not a couple of months, but a few days, they were able to build an ad hoc embankment to protect that. And then they brought in school buses, of all things, to serve as barriers for the wave action, really improvising this kind of tool. We've seen that after the earthquake in China in 2008. So we were there a few months afterwards in one rural community. And the landslides that were happening had destroyed a number of the bridges. In this particular area, there was a very deep but kind of narrow gorge, and they constructed a pulley system in order just to share supplies back and forth rather than going 5 miles down the road in order to get to the people on the other side. We see that in the leadership of bucket brigades, right? So somebody who's not an official, but somebody in the neighborhood who knows somebody who's stuck in the collapsed building, working together with neighbors, strangers, in order to help rescue people before officials get there. So all these different ways of emergence and people being surrounded by problems and then using that creativity to see their way through it.
This is definitely something that resonates with us, because through the settlements of the Division 2, we had this will of giving more space to civilians and this creativity, and building these settlements around three pillars, like finding the resources that are really lacking in this urban environment that is definitely not friendly to grow food or to, I don't know, find something like protein to it. We are so used to have the steak in our plate that it's just so easy. We don't even know how to hunt anymore. So these basic things that we have tendency to forget. So the first thing, the settlements find resources, and the agent of the division, you will help them finding resources. The second one is definitely the leadership and how you have some personalities that emerge from this crisis that, as you mentioned, maybe you didn't think about having the capacity, the abilities to be a leader and to bring people together and to motivate them and to help them seeing forward and having projects in a time that are super difficult to live in. And the other thing is like the new normal. How do we keep pushing forward and like having hard work and graffiti that we have in the game, for example, in the settlements, you have music playing, people still have hope, and this is something, yeah, we were super cautious and passionate about including in the game. This sense of hope in the settlement, because life goes on eventually.
So I'm just going to, there's so much stuff here that yeah. I'd like to talk to, but there's one little anecdote here which I think is super interesting, because obviously research was a big part of what we did, but it wasn't just talking to people in the city. It was also seeing maybe alternative ways of living. So one of the first trips, yeah, I think you helped organize this one, right? The Hunter trip. And the project's code name, by the way, was Hunter.
Yeah.
And the Hunter trip was, we had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to a car park outside of a Circle K in Maryland to do deer hunting in, you know, super early morning. It was deer hunting season, was gonna end in a few weeks. We go there, we're in the car park, two huge trucks come in, guys get out, crossbows, guns, we go into the forest. Everything's calm. And what we did that day was to follow a hunter in the outskirts of DC, finding prey, killing the prey, taking it to a butcher, then taking the meat from the butcher to a food bank for distribution that very same day. So you had this sort of almost post-pandemic way of dealing with food, and when we saw that whole chain happening, that was incredibly useful for us to start imagining, okay, what would life be like if you didn't have a store to go to get your meat. We killed Bambi.
Sad to hear, but I love that story. I think, you know, one other thing I want to touch on is, you know, how some of the things that are included in the settlements are some of the ingenious ways people have found to survive.
Yeah, the pulley system you mentioned in China, we have that in the rooftop settlement where they use pulleys to put resources at the top of the roof. They build wind turbines with just plastic and some ropes. They really like. We dig into a lot of sustainable projects and systems that people in times of crisis set up, or even like sustainable projects that are not even set up yet, just to make sure that we have, like, we wanted to nourish our settlement with that type of creativity and the fact that everyone coming together, as you said, someone has knowledge in something and they can help with something else. So yeah, this is something we have.
And don't you have school buses too for something as well?
When you mentioned school buses, it makes me think of the defenses of that same settlement. They use school buses to be able to armor themselves against the sort of threats that roam around in the streets. But one of the things that we were very much attached to, and this is a tricky thing in the type of game that we're making, is showing your actions as an agent having an impact and effect on not only the base of operations, but the settlements. So the side missions are very much intertwined with doing things that are going to improve the life of the settlement. So when you first find the settlement, it's going to really need help. But by working with the civilians, you're going to be able to see what are purification projects, hydroponic projects, a game corner, very important, ultimate. But doing all of these things helps the civilians also go out, gain confidence, and everybody has a role to play. And that is something that's incredibly important. That the agent is just the instigator of this. And then art comes back, music comes back, people are putting up graffiti, there's schools that start to emerge. So you can see that it's not just about survival. It's about building for a better tomorrow.
That actually happened after the Christchurch earthquake as well. So if you walk around the community, they would have an empty lot that they wanted to do something with it, and they actually put in headphones, and then eventually I think some of the headphones were getting wrecked, but you could go on your phone and dance, right? So you would be able to listen to the music, and there was a way to make an empty lot into something beautiful and to bring back music and bring back community.
With headphones.
That you would put your headphones on. And so you would be listening to the same music that another person would be listening to. But you turn that into a communal space.
That's great. Yeah. So people doing what needs to be done in order to build for the future.
Yeah. That same statement, people do what we do, what we need to do.
Yeah.
We actually heard that in our research after 9/11. So we interviewed mariners who were involved in evacuating 500,000 people by boat on that day, all in a single day, completely improvised from Manhattan. And over again, they said, we just did what we had to do. And I think it's a simple statement, but it reflects this idea of putting one foot in front of the other and improvising collectively to recover from disaster.
I love that because it's almost the ethos of the division agent. This is somebody who goes towards the danger and doesn't run away from it. These are people who have that in their blood. So that feels very good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really positive note for us to wrap the session. We started off really dark, but we got there. So thank you all so much for your time, Patricia. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.